Hello, friends, and welcome back to the show. Before we dive into the conversation, I want to take a moment to tell you all about Shady Rays. Before I say anything else, let me say this. What I'm about to lay out is not a paid ad. For the longest time, I kept seeing these ads on social media for these sunglasses, polarized, just the right fit, and they looked cool as hell. Well, then I checked out their website and I ordered two pairs. I have got to tell you, these are the best sunglasses I've ever owned. Shady Rays is an independent sunglass company that focuses on one thing, making the best shades for living active and worry-free in the outdoors. These shades feature shatter-resistant, high-visibility, polarized lenses, and durable construction. And the Shady Rays team stands behind them with free replacements if you lose or break them and a lifetime craftsmanship warranty. I can testify to this. If you break a pair of glasses or you simply lose them like I do, just reach out. All you have to do is pay for shipping. They send you another pair. Unbelievable. And here's what's really cool, friends. They didn't want to settle for being a company that just sells sunglasses. They wanted to make a difference with each purchase. Through research and talking directly to their fans, the Shady Rays team found the cause that gives purpose to their work. In partnership with Feeding America, Shady Rays donates 10 meals to fight hunger in America with every single order. One pair of sunglasses equals 10 meals. Thanks to their loyal customers, Shady Rays has provided over 9.4 million meals, and they continue to donate thousands of meals every day through Feeding America-sponsored food banks across the country. Folks, everyone needs a good pair of sunglasses. Stop paying hundreds for them and go to this website right now. Go to ShadyRays.com and check out their fantastic sunglasses. I promise you, you won't be disappointed. ShadyRays.com, make that purchase, give your eyes a much-needed break this summer, and help Feed America 10 meals at a time. And we are back. Mr. Brian Dunning, the podcast is Skeptoid. Sir, always a pleasure. Thank you for hanging out with me again tonight.
Thank you for letting me. It's always fun talking to you, man.
Absolutely. You know, it's funny. I for those that were listening to this, I remember the first time I heard your show, I think it was back in 14. I was listening to your, I think your initial piece on Earhart. You released that back in like 2012 or something, I think, right?
I've done, I don't know, two or three different episodes on that, which is unusual. Usually, yeah. There's so many urban legends in the world. It's very rare that I do more than one.
Yeah.
But Amelia Earhart, there was just so much misinformation being promoted by, you know, the TV networks and everything. It just kept coming back.
Yeah.
I just kind of had to keep hammering at it.
Yeah. Yeah. You did a couple follow-up pieces. We'll link them all, of course, but you're kind enough to, you know, make appearances on Chasing Earhart. And of course, what's now become season one of Vanish. Those were a lot of fun to record, man. So I really appreciate you doing that. And it's going to be fun tonight.
Yeah, me too.
So for folks who might not know, haven't heard Chasing Earhart, haven't heard Vanished, or haven't heard Skeptoid yet, give us a brief overview of sort of what you do with Skeptoid. Cause you've been doing this for a long time now.
A long time. 2006.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. It's been my full-time job for over a decade now. It's a craziness. Yeah.
Wow.
So Skeptoid is it's a short weekly podcast. It's 12 to 15 minutes. And each week we take a look at one popular urban legend, paranormal claim, ghost story, famous UFO case, or even things in modern pop culture like conspiracy theories or worthless alternative medicine schemes. Anything that a lot of people believe that's number one, not true, but number two, has a lot more interesting real history or real science behind it.
Yeah.
So the idea is that everyone, no matter what you think or what you believe, you can listen to the show and you're going to go, wow, that's cool. I learned something new.
Yeah.
Rather than, you know, just, it's not like debunking or anything like that. It's
right. Gotcha. Yeah. And we'll get into the time frame because I have an interesting question I kind of was thinking about yesterday that I want to ask you. But let's get into the structure of the show a little bit. So tell us about sort of how you approach the work you're doing. Cause I mean, you mentioned the time frame, it is kind of a short form show, but how do you approach sort of kind of the research and everything you do for a show? What do you like, what you pack into that time frame?
Yeah. I mean, you know, the old saying, you know, if I'd had more time, I'd have written you a shorter letter, right? It's hard to get a show in that short of a time format that can reasonably comprehensively address a whole subject.
Yeah.
Take something like the Amityville Horror or something like that. Something that people believe, oh, something weird happened in this house.
Yeah.
Well, so I've got it. My job is now to lay out the basics of the case, because there's some people who've never heard of that.
Right.
And then tell, you know, why people believe the version that's popular, what actually happened, and what lessons we can learn from that we can apply to other things that we encounter in life.
Yeah.
So it's a lot of research. Each week, each show does take a genuine full week of research and writing to put together basically 1,750 words,
right,
a short little article, then, you know, half a day to record and edit it.
Yeah. How many shows have you done now? Do you know?
722.
Good Lord. I can't imagine. That's incredible. That's a hell of an accomplishment. And you're, one of the, what they say, the OGs, the kids say it now. It's like, it's 2006. That's incredible. That's a long time in podcasting.
Yeah. And you know, the reason is because I got in so early, it was a lot easier to be a big fish in a small pond then.
Yeah.
If I were trying to start out now, I very much doubt that I'd be able to turn it into a career.
Yeah, I was reading an article. I don't know how accurate the article is, but I mean, I was reading an article that said something about like 800,000 podcasts now exist. It's insane. It's crazy how many podcasts are out there now.
Only Apple knows that true number.
Right,
It's enormous though. Yeah. And that, I mean, that's, people ask me all the time, hey, how can I make money from a podcast?
Yeah.
Realistically, the answer to that is you're not gonna.
Yeah.
Unless you are an existing Hollywood celebrity or someone who already has millions of followers.
Yeah.
The unfortunate fact is there's any show of any genre you come out with, you're immediately competing against a minimum of tens of thousands of shows, all of whom are more established than you, many of whom have a lot of money behind them, teams of producers and editors and writers. And none of that existed back in 2006. It was all, every podcast was basically, you know, a hobbyist, someone starting out and doing something by themselves and seeing how it goes. Mm. And I was very fortunate that my show resonated with a lot of listeners and kind of took over my life quicker than I was ready for.
What do you think about that sort of, well, I guess there's a two-part question. So has it changed, I think I know the answer to this, but has it changed the landscape with all these, as you mentioned, like these real famous people getting in doing their own podcast now? And then secondly, like, how do you think that's affected the podcasting just as a medium?
Our company is a nonprofit. And I say our because we've got half a dozen people working with us now.
Yeah.
And as an educational nonprofit, we have to follow a little bit different tax laws. And so we don't do advertising the same way that most other podcasts do. And that's kind of become the de facto financing model for a podcast now.
Yeah.
So since we can't do that, we can only run sponsored messages, the kind you might hear on an NPR podcast. It's tough for us to stay afloat financially without listener donations, just by virtue of the limitations on what we can advertise on the show.
Yeah.
Now, the competition... You've got these companies who have venture capital behind them, who immediately start off with 100 employees, with teams of writers and researchers and everything, and hired talents to do the shows and everything. And they can attract all the advertising. In fact, all the advertisers spend almost all of their money with those few podcast networks.
Yeah.
And still, every single one of them is losing money and losing money hand over fist.
Yeah.
So, you mentioned how is that changing the industry? I mean, it's changing it today.
Yeah.
Because these companies right now, that we already see some consolidation taking place, you know, what's it going to look like tomorrow and a year from now? I don't even know, because these advertisers are going to start dropping out, because generally advertisers are not getting the value they're hoping to out of their podcast advertisements.
Yeah.
And the companies that are taking investor capital to do, you know, branded content and original programs, none of them are making money. They make great shows. Don't get me wrong. There's a lot of really good shows out there and I love it.
Right.
But as far as someone finding a way to turn it into a business model, that's proving to be very tough. And it is a very dynamic industry. Every year, it looks very different than the year before.
And then touching on sort of like the time frame of the show and kind of how long the show is, I wanted to follow up that one question I asked with the decision to make it short, kind of a short form show. Was that kind of something you kind of decided from the outset when you were kind of structuring the show way back when, before you started, like, I want to keep this short and sweet, essentially?
It was. And there was a couple of reasons I did that. First of all, because it was a hobby. It was something I had to do alongside my regular full-time job at the time.
Yeah.
So I didn't have time to make a longer show. And secondly, I knew that I didn't want to do interviews.
Yeah.
First of all, there were very few interview shows back then. now pretty much every show is an interview show, which on the one hand makes it easy because you have to worry less about your content.
Right.
But on the other hand, it's hard, as you know, because now you're dealing with scheduling people and people drop out and there's audio problems.
Right.
And it introduces a whole new set of problems. And I didn't want to deal with any of that. So I said, okay, here's something that's bite-sized, that's going to be what I thought at the time, easy to produce relatively.
Yeah.
And it turned out to be so beneficial in so many ways. I would name the top two. The top two benefits to having a very short format show like that is, number one, the transcripts are all on the website, complete. Google loves them.
Yeah.
If you do a search for any urban legend ever, I'm almost always one of the top two or three results. And the second reason that is people just genuinely love it. I always hear from people who say, hey, I can listen to it on my commute when I'm riding the subway or whatever.
Yep.
And they get to listen to a complete show or two or three sometimes.
Yeah, that's my favorite part about it. I love it. It's a great appetite whetter. Like, it gives you, like, if you, especially if it's a topic you haven't heard of previously, you get a really good kind of a snapshot of that topic in, you know, 10, 15 minutes. And that's one of my favorite aspects of the show. So
yeah, it works great for the modern attention span.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So I know we talked a little bit offline about this, but I just want to kind of address the whole coronavirus pandemic that we're sort of all dealing with right now. You have a really great FAQ on the website. We'll link it in the show notes. First, how you holding up, and what are your thoughts on everything that's sort of surrounding this virus, all the information that's out there? It's like we can't get information on this thing fast enough now.
Yeah. Well, as far as how I'm holding up, so far, so good. It's interesting. I mean, it is a fascinating, fascinating, weird time. Every day is weird.
Yeah. that's a great way to put it. You know, it just kind of, you know, kind of segueing off of that into some other topics. I mean, just generally speaking, like when you're investigating a claim, some of the ones that, I mean, you've done so many that you've kind of looked into, what are some of the questions you ask yourself, I guess, sort of in order to sort of ascertain truth? I know that's kind of a broad word, but like, I feel like things like, you know, is it plausible? What's the source material? What's the consensus? Stuff like that's maybe a good way to start. But what do you ask yourself? What do you sort of bring to the table when you're investigating something, when you're starting that investigation?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, it's hard to find any urban legend that nobody has written about before, right?
Right. So right.
How do I make this into, you know, how do I add value to the history of this narrative?
Yeah.
So my job is always to find something that either has not been reported before or has gotten very little attention before. And that's something that you find by going back to the oldest, most original, first generation sources that you can. So that's really always the basic question, is how can I get the best possible information on this subject? Not the information that's been told and retold and copied and pasted from website to website and from book to website to book to website and to Discovery Channel.
Yeah.
It's always a matter of finding old documentation, old newspapers, old books, finding those original sources.
Yeah.
So it's a hell of a lot of fun from the perspective of just every week being a new detective story.
I bet. I mean, I know we've talked about this before offline, but I mean, this is the one question you've probably been asked a million times, but I think it bears repeating just for this show as well. But what do you think draws people to conspiracy just in general?
Last year, I wrote a book on conspiracy theories, Conspiracies Declassified, from Simon & Schuster, available wherever books are sold. Thank you very much.
Nice plug.
Conspiracy theories are attractive in a number of ways. First of all, our brains are all hardwired for a certain amount of paranoia. And this is an evolved trait that goes all the way back to the dawn of humanity. The people who are a little bit more paranoid are the ones who tend to survive threats better. Hmm. Other than that, you know, it's a conspiracy theory is generally extremely oversimplified. Jews are secretly controlling the banks.
Right.
Something like that. That's
right.
That's a ridiculously simplified narrative that can't hope to encompass the reality of international finance. You take a subject that's incredibly complicated, apply a very simple explanation to it, and now suddenly it becomes something that we can all wrap our arms around and comprehend. We go, I understand that.
Right.
And another aspect of it is that it is very appealing to believe that you have a superior knowledge level to all those other people out there,
yeah.
You know, the sheeple.
Yeah.
I know better than all the sheeple because I know the hidden, forbidden knowledge.
Right.
So that's something that's deeply appealing to us at an organic level. So it's simple, it's easy, it's empowering, and it's in our genes.
Yeah.
So the surprise is that more people don't believe in conspiracy theories.
I feel like there's like with people, like people either believe, like if you're a skeptic, you know, if naturally if you gravitate toward that, or if you want to question, you know, everything that you read. I mean, George Carlin famously said it's not important for people to, you know, people, it's important, more important for people to question everything that they read, you know, instead of just kind of taking everything they read as, you know, as gospel. But I feel like people believe they're either all skeptic or they're all conspiracy. There's no gray area. Is there a certain mindset that you have to have in order to be considered a quote unquote a skeptic? Or is that just kind of, hey, I'm just taking a look at it as everything kind of appears to me?
Yeah, I mean, you raise a number of points there. My podcast is called Skeptoid. Okay. Yeah. So people say, oh, skeptics. Oh, so you're the people who think 9/11 was an inside job.
Yeah.
And we didn't actually go to the moon. And so if I could go back in time, I would name the show anything else because
right.
immediately
right.
people get the wrong idea.
Yeah.
So, I mean, skepticism is not cynicism.
Right.
It's not simply doubting the official story. Skepticism is the process of, it's the same as the scientific method. It's the process of finding out the evidence that supports what's actually going on in the world.
Yeah.
What is the situation? What is real? What is supported by evidence that's testable?
Yeah.
That's how we know what's real and what's not. That's basically the scientific method. And that's basically what skepticism is. It's having a standard of evidence.
Yeah.
So you can support anything you want if your standard of evidence is very low. And if you can take any belief that's prominent on the internet right now, you know, if we could go back in time before COVID-19 was the only thing everyone was talking about.
Right.
People were talking about the thing with the Pentagon is acknowledging the existence of aliens.
Oh, we'll get there.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I can't wait.
Which, of course, they never were. It's one small little group of alien visitation believers sending press releases to all the newspapers saying that the Pentagon believes in UFOs.
Yeah.
Pentagon's not saying that.
Yeah.
And so it's a matter of applying a standard of evidence. That's very, very poor evidence that someone sent out a press release. That doesn't prove anything.
Yeah.
But for many people, that's all they need to suddenly accept that as gospel.
You know, what I've always found interesting is that, and that's something I wanted to ask you about for a while too, is people will, like, you know, they'll pick a story, they'll pick an idea, and they'll believe in that idea or that story completely, but other ideas they'll think, you know, are nuts. So for instance, someone might completely believe in Bigfoot, but when it comes to hauntings or the supernatural, well, that's just crazy. It's too far gone. So, I mean, I want to ask you, like, is it a matter of just sort of gravitating to something that you personally connect with? I mean, what do you think that is, that some people will believe one thing but not believe another? Why is that?
So it is true. And there's lots of academic research in this area. It is true that people who believe in one weird thing are far more likely to believe in all the other weird things too.
Yeah.
I mean, people tend to be at one end of the spectrum or the other. There's very few people who believe in aliens, but not Bigfoot, or Bigfoot, but not ghosts. You know, it's generally you take the whole thing or you take none of it. When you've got people who do believe in one weird thing, but not in other weird things, a lot of times I'll get emails from listeners and they'll say, hey, my mom/neighbor/coworker believes in weird thing X. Do you have a podcast episode about that I can play for her and change her mind?
Huh.
And I always say, yes, I do, but don't play that for her.
Right.
Instead, find another subject that you both agree on that she doesn't believe, and play that episode for her and get her interested in the reasons why we know what we know and why that knowledge process is what's truly interesting about these stories. And then play another episode for her. And get her to a point where she will, on her own, come to question the strange belief that she has.
Yeah.
Because when you immediately go after somebody's sacred cow, you know, their cherished belief, and attack it, they're just going to shut you off. And they're not going to listen to anything else you say. So don't do that. Don't ever confront someone directly by attacking their belief. Come at them from the back door. Come at them from the side door.
Yeah.
Find the common ground and build on that bridge.
Is there a story you've ever investigated that you thought to yourself, oh, I really want this one to be true? There's got to be a personal one, like a person for, like, you know, like, I'm not going to put words in your mouth, but like, I really wish like the Bigfoot thing was real. I really wish, you know, the Roswell was real, whatever, you know, spiritual, you know, hauntings. I mean, whatever, you take your pick. But I mean, is there anything for you personally that you were just like, I hope there's some merit to some of this?
So the answer to your question is, of course, yes. Hmm. A lot of times people assume that every time I sit down to investigate some famous urban legend, I've already made my mind up that it's bogus and I'm going to debunk it.
Right.
And that couldn't be further from the truth at all, because in many cases, I haven't heard of this story either. I mean, with 722 episodes, I don't know 722 urban legends.
Yeah.
So a lot of times when I come and sit down to a story and I start investigating and I find that it was completely different than any idea that I might have had of it. There's a number of different types of surprises that I run into. One of these is that the story turns out to be incredibly lame.
Yeah.
The truth was something so completely mundane and uninteresting that it's a miracle that an urban legend even exists about it. I think my favorite example of that is Flight 19.
Yeah.
The famous flight that was so important to the Bermuda Triangle mythology.
Yeah.
This flight of five aircraft that flew out over the ocean, and supposedly their instruments all went crazy and the sky changed colors or whatever happened, and they all disappeared and were never found.
Yeah.
And in effect, what ended up happening in that, and I didn't know this, I'd never looked into the story before, so I honestly had no idea what I would find. But plenty of other researchers have, and of course the U.S. Navy has the entire story in total detail, all available for anyone to look at.
Yeah.
Is the guy who was the leader of this flight was simply a terrible navigator, to the point that twice he had fought in World War II over the Pacific, and twice he had gotten lost and had to ditch a plane for running out of fuel because he had no idea where he was.
Yeah.
This is a guy who just tragically had no sense of direction whatsoever. And he was the leader of Flight 19.
Yeah.
And when they went out east from the Florida Panhandle, he thought they were west over the Gulf of Mexico, which is an astounding error. So he looks down at his compasses and they're pointing the opposite direction. So he says over the radio, "My compasses are screwed up. We got to go this way." And of course they kept going that way and they ran out of fuel and all died.
Yeah.
And based on that alone, this one author, Charles Berlitz, magnified and amplified that and added layers and layers and layers of dramatization and fiction on top of this to make it seem like it was some unaccountable case of all the planes breaking down and the instruments didn't work and the radios didn't work and everything.
Yeah.
And it just turned out to be this one tragic character who was just unaccountably clueless at navigating.
Yeah, Flight 19 is an interesting story, and it's very popular, of course, and all that. And we'll have a link to some of the Flight 19 stuff as well. But I wanted to ask you. I was just talking to Jessica Manor yesterday. She's the co-host of a show called Body Count, and it's they cover a lot of historical events where a lot of people lost their lives as a result of the event. They talked about Pearl Harbor. They did like a really deep dive on Genghis Khan, which is really, really great. She mentioned something interesting. She said she doesn't incorporate show notes into the episodes. She wants people listening to sort of hear her show, get invested in a topic, and go out and sort of do their own research, buy their own books on the topic, and really just sort of consume, you know, voluntarily without her recommending sort of a specific path for them to go down. So, I mean, I was wondering what your thoughts are on that idea, because I liked it. I thought it was interesting, kind of encourages people to kind of do their own research and look into something. But what do you think about that idea?
You know, I think it depends on the subject matter. If you're talking about economics or mathematics or something like that, yes, that is an absolutely great strategy.
Yeah.
Or planetary science. Yes, go get people to go out and learn new stuff on their own.
Yeah.
But when you're talking about urban legends and things that are in popular culture, the amount of information that's out there that's misinformation tremendously outnumbers the good information out there.
Right.
So if I were to do an episode on, like, for example, what's trending right now on the website is the Russian sleep experiment.
Yeah.
You know, kind of a silly urban legend that never actually happened. It was just someone's little piece of fiction, but a lot of people believe it was real.
Yeah.
And if you go out and do a search for the Russian sleep experiment, you're going to find all of these articles claiming that it was a real thing and that it was all these incredibly weird, unexplainable things happened.
Right.
And you're actually going to de-educate and misinform your audience.
Yeah.
So while I think her perspective is a fine one, I think it depends greatly on the subject matter.
Yeah.
If you're talking about urban legends, no, I wouldn't. I would rather give the people the tools first to discern what's real from what's not.
Yeah.
And get them excited about how we know what we know and why the truth is almost always more interesting than the fiction.
And I think sort of kind of as we kind of wind down on the talk we're going to, you know, we're doing tonight, just a question, just a general question. This might be a loaded question, but I mean, I love to kind of ask your opinion on this, but do you ever think, like, as a society, a culture, species, however you want to say it, do you ever think we'll ever get to the point where we'll become more skeptical by nature? Or do you think there's always going to be a natural curiosity when it comes to potential, you know, alternate history, for lack of a better term?
The latter is the short answer is the latter for me. And this is something that a lot of my colleagues and I will disagree about and talk about a lot. But in my experience, people are people. And when I go back and read a book written by Martin Gardner 100 years ago, 75 years ago, he's talking about the exact same urban legends of strange beliefs, just with different names than we would be reading about them today. They were exactly the same 100 years ago, 200 years ago, 1,000 years ago.
Yeah.
I mean, I've done so many different shows on what weird beliefs people had at different times in history. I honestly believe that people are people, and the amount of sort of, whether it's conspiracy ideation or tendency to believe in the paranormal, I think that's just something that's kind of hardwired into our brains.
Yeah.
I think it's going to be the same 100, 500, 1,000 years from now in the future as it is today.
So as we wrap up tonight, one of the things I wanted to do with you is when I told, you know, folks we're gonna have you back on the show and everything, for this particular show, people started to give me a list. Okay, they say, I want you to ask him about these ideas and these people, these instances, and just get his opinion on it.
Awesome. I love this. Yeah. I get this all the time. So fire away.
Yeah. A lot of fun. You know, you don't have to go too deep into it. It's as deep as you want to go, of course, but we're going to run through a few of them here. First one is a big one, obviously, 9/11. What are your thoughts on that whole idea, the insiders and the conspiracy and all that?
Yeah. I mean, the conspiracy theories are so insanely far out there.
Yeah.
And I'm not just talking about the stories like the planes were holograms or things like that, the things that's obviously nutty, but even the idea of, you know, George Bush knew about it in advance and just allowed it to happen.
Yeah,
when you actually go in there and you read the 9/11 reports, you're talking about literally thousands of pages of every movement that these terrorists made over years before they flew the planes into the tower. I mean, there is so much investigation and data. It's a staggering amount of data that proves what we all witnessed happened as we witnessed it happening on that day.
Right.
And every single piece of evidence supporting any other narrative is purely a made up anecdote that just, it's an idea that someone's had that happens to be consistent with an alternate version of the event that they prefer.
Yeah.
That supports their idea that government is evil and always trying to kill its own people, or whatever their idea is.
Right.
So there is really, I can't come down finding any part of any 9/11 truthism to be plausible in the slightest.
What about the idea, this is something that's near and dear to me right now, we're working sort of on this, but the idea that John Wilkes Booth, the assassination of Lincoln, we're going all the way back to 1865 here, but the idea that President Johnson called the shots, there was a big conspiracy about him maybe surviving that night in the bar in Garrett's barn in 1865 and sort of living and marrying in 1872 and all this insane stuff that we're just kind of like looking into right now. Like, what do you think of that whole idea? The whole idea of him surviving, and really the whole idea of him conspiring potentially with President Johnson, you know, to kill Lincoln that night.
So, haven't done a show about that, and I don't want to speak outside of, you know, what I'm familiar with. But the show that I did do was the urban legend comparing the assassination of Lincoln to the assassination of Kennedy.
Yeah,
you know, we've all seen all these web pages finding all of these things that match between the two of them.
Yeah,
you know, to the point of, well, both assassins had the same number of letters in their name.
Right.
Goofy stuff like that. And during the course of that research, you know, you're taking something that was largely just made up by somebody and they put a web page together, and you're in the position of having to do serious research to debunk it.
Right.
I did get somewhat deep into the official reports of tracking down John Wilkes Booth and everything.
Yeah.
And I would say, without having done an episode on this,
yeah,
my expectation is that I would find something very similar to what I was just talking about with 9/11, that the evidence proving the event as history records it,
yeah,
is very substantial, and the evidence supporting some alternate version of history is essentially non-existent.
Yeah, yeah. Well, what about, I mean, I won't ask you about anything specific, because I feel like you can sort of, I don't want to say you can lump all this in, but I mean, just UFOs in general. Roswell's a big one, obviously. Everybody kind of knows about Roswell. There's UFOs are bigger than ever now. I mean, pop culture, all these, like, you know, History Channel documentaries and docudramas and things on them. What do you think of that just in general, as far as all the evidence that's been put forth to support UFOs existing?
So I come down pretty much straight in line with the vast majority of astronomers, cosmologists, theoretical physicists. Generally, the belief in the scientific community is that there's absolutely life out there.
Yeah.
That it's just going by the size of space alone, it's insane to think that there's not other life out there, including intelligent life.
Yeah, good point.
On the other side of that coin is, from everything we know about the way the universe works, is it's essentially impossible, because of the tremendous distances involved, for one intelligent civilization to ever be able to visit another.
Yeah.
And the analogy I like to give is, imagine a Christmas tree with blinking lights, okay? Right. There's blinking lights throughout the Christmas tree, turning on, blinking on, it's on for a few seconds, then it's dark. And the chances of two lights blinking on right next to each other, literally right next to each other, and being on at the same time is extremely remote.
Yeah.
So civilizations don't last that long compared to the life of the universe. And the evidence that we don't observe any evidence on Earth that we've ever been visited by any flying saucers from outer space.
Yeah.
And we have very good science showing that it's just simply not going to be possible.
Okay, this is going to be a fun one. The next two are actually the next three are personal favorites. Flat Earth.
Oh my God. I had so much fun doing my Flat Earth episodes.
Yeah.
Because that story turned out to be so much broader and go so much deeper than I ever had any idea.
Yeah.
You know, we've got the modern flat earth. The modern flat earth belief is basically wrapped up with conspiracy mongering and kind of modern alternative science proponents and conspiracy theorists.
Yeah.
But there's this whole second chapter of the original Flat Earth Society that goes back not too far back. It only goes back to about the 1800s.
Right.
Which was all made of biblical literalists who were trying to prove the literal truth of the Bible based on a few passages that they felt indicated the earth was flat.
Yeah.
And so they were doing all of these wonderful experiments and everything, trying to prove that the earth was flat. And then there's this period in, like, starting in the 1970s that lasts for, you know, 20, 25 years or so, where there was no flat earth belief.
Right.
And then suddenly it reemerges during the early days of the internet.
Yeah.
As a completely different story. So that was a wonderful, wonderful subject to research.
Yeah, a lot of fun. Okay, a couple more, and then we'll kind of wrap up. The Mount Rushmore Chamber of Secrets is one of my all time favorite ones. That was famously, you know, put in the National Treasure 2 book movie, and it's been widely, you know, talked about and debated online. Is there a Chamber of Secrets attached to Mount Rushmore? let's talk about that for a little bit.
Okay, I haven't done that episode either. Okay. Do you want to ask me about the alien library buried under the Sphinx?
That's another very similar. Yeah, let's go with that. I mean, we'll compare the two, sure. that whole thing is just, like, you know, insane to me. Like, the whole idea of, really, both of those, they're really similar, but yeah, just that whole idea is crazy, I think.
It's crazy, but there's interesting things that you go, oh, well, that's kind of interesting. So this goes back to the whole Chariots of the Gods thing, where you had people believing that there is a library buried in a chamber underneath the Sphinx.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And you'd think, well, gee, wouldn't it be easy enough to just do some subsurface radar surveys and prove that there's either a chamber under there or there's not.
Right.
Well, of course, that's been done. It's been done ad nauseum. And what's also been done is a lot of drilling. But the reason the drilling has been done is not because researchers in Egypt think that this chamber might be real, it's because they're concerned about the water table rising up underneath the Sphinx and they're and potentially damaging the Sphinx, as we're seeing damage kind of throughout the site.
Yeah.
And reading about this, it turns out there's something like half a dozen hidden tunnels and hidden chambers in and around the Sphinx.
Yeah.
And yeah. So you hear that, and you know, that's enough to say, well, gee, maybe one of those is the entrance to this chamber. But no, these are all documented with extreme thoroughness. You can read, there's books written about every single one of these.
Yeah.
And you know, we know that this one was dug by these Egyptologists in the 1920s because they were trying to do this or that, or what. We know the history of all of these little chambers. And the fact is, there simply is no hidden chamber under the Sphinx.
All right. Last one, President's Secret Book.
You know, there have been so many authors who have written books and built careers on every single detail about the office of the presidency.
Yeah.
I was friends with a guy who wrote a book about the presidential China. I mean, the pens on his desk all have stories and books written about him.
Right.
The idea that there might be some kind of a book like that, first of all, it seems perfectly plausible to me, and I wouldn't be surprised at all.
Right.
But the fact that it would be secret or its existence would be denied doesn't match reality at all. Because if this book exists, well, there's going to be security around it. And the Secret Service is going to have a contingency plan for, here's how we protect the book, here's where it's stored, here's what you do, and it's going to have all these protocols around it and everything.
Yeah.
And that kind of thing means that these protocols and rules are written down in a manual someplace.
Yeah.
There's virtually nothing like that that is secret or denied.
All right. Well, we're going to, before we sort of get out of here tonight, one thing we've been doing in the last, I don't know, three or four shows now, we've been incorporating a piece of the very famous interview show, Inside the Actor's Studio. Did you ever see that show? Inside the Actor's Studio?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. All right. So one of my favorite aspects of that show was the whole questionnaire that that James Lipton asked every guest that sat on stage with him on the show. And it's such a great way for us, our listeners, to sort of get to know, you know, podcasters and authors and people that we have on the show sort of on a personal level. So is it okay if I ask you those questions and we'll kind of wrap up with that tonight?
Absolutely.
All right. So let's start with the first question. What is your favorite word?
Skeletonized.
That's a great word. That's a great word. That's a really great one. All right. What is your least favorite word?
The C word.
Yeah, me too. What turns you on, sir?
My wife.
What about the opposite? What turns you off?
I don't like to say, because there are things that turn me off that a lot of people do, and they do it because it's cool, and I don't want to seem like I'm one of those guys. So I'm going to keep that secret.
All right. Well, that's respectful.
That's probably not allowed, but I'm going to.
That's okay. Well, what about what sound or noise do you love?
A sound or noise? My daughter laughing.
Yeah.
That was easy.
That's a great one. Yeah. What about the opposite? What sound or noise do you hate?
People chewing. There are certain people who, when they hear a certain sound, it affects them emotionally. And when I hear people chewing or chewing with their mouths open, it's not just, oh, that's gross or that's annoying. It actually raises my stress level through the roof and gets me angry.
Wow. Interesting.
And this is a fairly new condition that's only been described in the past 5 or 10 years or so.
Wow.
I eagerly read the scientific literature on it, looking for a solution.
Right.
Every time I get a chance.
I don't know if I'll get you to go with this one either, but we'll try. What is your favorite curse word?
Well, I always go with great thunder and lightning, and I don't know why I do, but that's just what pops out of me if I don't have time to think about it, which is good, because otherwise I'd be using the words you're not supposed to say.
Right. Yeah. That's a good alternate. What profession other than your own would you like to attempt?
Let's see. In my 20s, I was absolutely dead set on being a Formula One driver. That probably wouldn't have worked out. I think the one that has lasted my whole life is I would like to be a P-38 Lightning owner operator.
Yeah, wow, that's a great man after my own heart. What profession would you absolutely not like to attempt?
Anything that requires me to crank on a tie every morning and go to an office. People are always telling me, gee, you should be a lawyer.
Yeah.
No, I would kill myself if I had to be a lawyer.
Yeah. No. That's the best part of working from home. It's like you don't have to get dressed to go to work. I mean, you just put a shirt on and you're good to go, you know, for whatever, if you're doing video meetings or whatever, and you're good to go. Okay. So the last one is, it's probably the most profound. If heaven exists, what would you like to hear God say when you arrive at the pearly gates?
I'm done. You're in charge.
That's great. All right. The podcast is Skeptoid. Please plug the website, plug the podcast everywhere people can listen to it, all that jazz.
Just come to skeptoid.com or search for Skeptoid wherever you get your podcasts.
This has been a pleasure. Like I said, this is probably, I think, the third time we've recorded together, third or fourth. And it's always a pleasure. I always learn more stuff. And I was looking forward to talking with you and going a little bit more wide than studying Earhart together. But I really appreciate you, Brian. Thank you so much, man.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. It's fun as always.
If you made it all the way through our conversation tonight, I want to thank you for hanging out with me and my friends. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Please visit us on social media as we post each new conversation as they air, news, show information, and much more. Go to facebook.com/meandmyfriendspod. On Twitter, you can search the handle meMyFriendsPod. And on Instagram, you can find us by searching the handle @meandmyfriendspod. If you enjoyed our conversation tonight, please do me a favor and head to iTunes to rate us and leave us a review. As a brand new podcast, we need all the help we can get, and your time is truly appreciated. Me and My Friends is produced by Vanessa Williamson and edited by me, Chris Williamson. Tonight, the podcast featured the original track, Cold Hearted, by producer Redman. The opinions on Me and My Friends are those of the individual guests and may not reflect those of Chris Evan Films Incorporated. Chris Evan Films Incorporated is not affiliated with the films or clips referred to herein. Any audio clips used in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purposes of education and entertainment, and no infringement is ever intended. Me and My Friends is an exclusive trademark of Chris Evan Films Incorporated and may not be used without the express written consent of Chris Evan Films Incorporated, all rights reserved. Me and My Friends is a Chris Evan Films production, copyright 2020, all rights reserved.